Chapter 4. Tar and Tin. The city that had grown up around the university over the centuries was not large. It was barely more than a town, really. Despite this, trade thrived at our end of the Great Stone Road. Merchants brought in carts of raw materials, tar and clay, gibstone, potash, and sea salt. They brought luxuries like Lanetti coffee and vintage wine. They brought fine dark ink from Arua, pure white sand for our glassworks, and delicately crafted sealed-ish springs and screws. When those same merchants left, their wagons were laden with things you could only find at the university. The Medica made medicines. Real medicines, not colored stump water or penny nostrums. The alchemy complex produced its own marvels that I was only dimly aware of, as well as raw materials like naphtha, sulfur jack, and twice lime. I might be biased, but I think it's fair to say that most of the university's tangible wonders came from the artificery. Ground glass lenses, ingots of wolfram and glanz steel, sheets of gold so thin they tore like tissue paper. But we made much more than that. Sympathy lamps and telescopes, heat eaters and gear winds, salt pumps, trifoil compasses, a dozen versions of Teckham's winch and Delavari's axle. Artificers like myself made these things, and when merchants bought them, we earned a commission, 60% of the sale. This was the only reason I had any money at all, and since there were no classes during admissions, I had a full span of days to work in the fishery. I made my way to the stocks, the storeroom where artificers signed out tools and materials. I was surprised to see a tall, pale student standing at the window, looking profoundly bored. "Jackson?" I asked. "What are you doing here? This is a scrub job." Jackson nodded morosely. "Gilvin is still a little vexed with me," he said. "You know, the fire and everything." "Sorry to hear it," I said. Jackson was a full Ralar like myself. He could be pursuing any number of projects on his own right now. To be forced into a menial task like this wasn't just boring. It humiliated Jackson publicly while costing him money and stalling his studies. As punishments went, it was remarkably thorough. "What are we short on?" I asked. "There was an art to choosing your projects in the fishery. It didn't matter if you made the brightest sympathy lamp or the most efficient heat funnel in the history of artificing. Until someone bought it, you wouldn't make a bent penny of commission." For a lot of the other workers, this wasn't an issue. They could afford to wait. I, on the other hand, needed something that would sell quickly. Jackson leaned on the counter between us. "Caravan just bought all our deck lamps," he said. "We only have that ugly one of Vestin's left." I nodded. Sympathy lamps were perfect for ships. Difficult to break, cheaper than oil in the long run, and you didn't have to worry about them setting fire to your ship. I juggled the numbers in my head. I could make 2 lamps at once, saving some time through duplication of effort, and be reasonably sure they would sell before I had to pay tuition. Unfortunately, deck lamps were pure drudgery. 40 hours of painstaking labor, and if I botched any of it, the lamp simply wouldn't work. Then I would have nothing to show for my time except a debt to the stocks for the materials I'd wasted. Still, I didn't have a lot of options. "I guess I'll do lamps then," I said. Jackson nodded and opened the ledger. I began to recite what I needed from memory. "I'll need 20 medium raw emitters, 2 sets of the tall moldings, a diamond stylus, a tentant glass, 2 medium crucibles, 4 ounces of tin, 6 ounces of fine steel, 2 ounces of nickel." Nodding to himself, Jackson wrote it down in the ledger. 8 hours later, I walked through the front door of Anchors, smelling of hot bronze, tar, and coal smoke. It was almost midnight, and the room was empty except for a handful of dedicated drinkers.
"You look rough,"
Anchor said, as I made my way to the bar.
"I feel rough," I said.
"I don't suppose there's anything left in the pot." He shook his head.
"Folk were hungry tonight. I've got some cold potatoes I was going to throw in the soup tomorrow, and half a baked squash, I think."
Sold, I said. Though I'd be grateful for some salt butter as well.
He nodded and pushed away from the bar.
Don't bother heating anything up, I said. I'll just take it up to my room.
He brought out a bowl with 3 good-sized potatoes and half a golden squash shaped like a bell. There was a generous daub of butter in the middle of the squash where the seeds had been scooped out.
I'll take a bottle of bread and beer, too, I said as I took the bowl, with the cap on. I don't want to spill on the stairs.
It was 3 flights up to my tiny room. After I closed the door, I carefully turned the squash upside down in the bowl, setting the bottle on top of it, and wrapped the whole thing in a piece of sackcloth, turning it into a bundle I could carry under one arm. Then, I opened my window and climbed out onto the roof of the inn. From there, it was a short hop over to the bakery across the alley. A piece of moon hung low in the sky, giving me enough light to see without making me feel exposed. Not that I was too worried. It was approaching midnight, and the streets were quiet. Besides, you would be amazed how rarely people ever look up. Ari sat on a wide brick chimney waiting for me. She wore the dress I had bought her and swung her bare feet idly as she looked up at the stars. Her hair was so fine and light that it made a halo around her head, drifting on the faintest whisper of a breeze. I carefully stepped onto the middle of a flat piece of tin roofing. It made a low thump under my foot, like a distant mellow drum. Ari's feet stopped swinging, and she went motionless as a startled rabbit. Then she saw me and grinned. I waved to her. Ari hopped down from the chimney and skipped over to where I stood, her hair streaming behind her.
"Hello, Kvothe." She took a half step back. "You reek."
I smiled my best smile of the day.
"Hello, Ari,"
I said. "You smell like a pretty young girl."
"I do,"
she agreed happily. She stepped sideways a little, then forward again, moving lightly on the balls of her bare feet.
"What did you bring me?" she asked.
"What did you bring me?" I countered. She grinned.
"I have an apple that thinks it's a pear," she said, holding it up, "and a bun that thinks it's a cat, and a lettuce that thinks it's a lettuce."
"It's a clever lettuce, then."
"Hardly," she said with a delicate snort. "Why would anything clever think it was a lettuce?"
"Even if it is a lettuce?" I asked.
"Especially then," she said. "Bad enough to be a lettuce. How awful to think you are a lettuce, too."
She shook her head sadly, her hair following the motion as if she were underwater. I unwrapped my bundle. "I brought you some potatoes, half a squash, and a bottle of beer that thinks it's a loaf of bread."
"What does the squash think it is?"
she asked curiously, looking down at it. She held her hands clasped behind her back. "It knows it's a squash," I said, "but it's pretending to be the setting sun."
"And the potatoes?" she asked.
"They're sleeping," I said. "And cold, I'm afraid." She looked up at me, her eyes gentle.
"Don't be afraid," she said,
and reached out and rested her fingers on my cheek for the space of a heartbeat, her touch lighter than the stroke of a feather.
"I'm here. You're safe."
The night was chill, and so rather than eat on the rooftops, as we often did, Ari led me down through the iron drainage grate and into the sprawl of tunnels beneath the university. She carried the bottle and held aloft something the size of a coin that gave off a gentle greenish light. I carried the bowl and the sympathy lamp I'd made myself, the one Kilvin had called a thieves' lamp. Its reddish light was an odd complement to Ari's brighter blue-green one. Ari brought us to a tunnel with pipes in all shapes and sizes running along the walls. Some of the larger iron pipes carried steam, and even wrapped in insulating cloth, they provided a steady heat. Ari carefully arranged the potatoes at a bend in the pipe where the cloth had been peeled away. It made a tiny oven of sorts. Using my sackcloth as a table, we sat on the ground and shared our dinner. The bun was a little stale, but it had nuts and cinnamon in it. The head of lettuce was surprisingly fresh, and I wondered where she had found it. She had a porcelain teacup for me and a tiny silver beggar's cup for herself. She poured the beer so solemnly you'd think she was having tea with the king.
There was no talking during dinner. That was one of the rules I had learned through trial and error. No touching, no sudden movement, no questions even remotely personal. I could not ask about the lettuce or the green coin. Such a thing would send her scampering off into the tunnels, and I wouldn't see her for days afterward. Truth be told, I didn't even know her real name. Ari was just what I had come to call her, but in my heart, I thought of her as my little moon fae. As always, Ari ate delicately. She sat with her back straight, taking small bites. She had a spoon we used to eat the squash, sharing it back and forth.
"You didn't bring your lute," she said, after we had finished eating.
"I have to go read tonight," I said. "But I'll bring it soon."
"How soon?"
6 nights from now," I said. I'd be finished with admissions then, and more studying would be pointless. Her tiny face pulled a frown.
6 days isn't soon," she said. "Tomorrow is soon."
6 days is soon for a stone," I said.
"Then play for a stone in 6 days," she said, "and play for me tomorrow."
"I think you can be a stone for 6 days," I said. "It's better than being a lettuce." She grinned at that.
"It is."
After we finished the last of the apple, Ari led me through the underthing. We went quietly along the nodway, jumped our way through vaults, then entered billows, a maze of tunnels filled with a slow, steady wind. I probably could have found my own way, but I preferred to have Ari as a guide. She knew the underthing, like a tinker knows his packs. Willem was right. I was banned from the archives. But I've always had a knack for getting into places where I shouldn't be. More's the pity. Archives was a huge, windowless stone block of a building. But the students inside needed fresh air to breathe, and the books needed more than that. If the air was too moist, the books would rot and mildew. If the air was too dry, the parchment would become brittle and fall to pieces. It had taken me a long time to discover how fresh air made its way into the archives, but even after I found the proper tunnel, getting in wasn't easy. It involved a long crawl through a terrifyingly narrow tunnel, a quarter hour worming along on my belly across the dirty stone. I kept a set of clothes in the underthing, and after barely a dozen trips were thoroughly ruined, the knees and elbows almost entirely worn out. Still, it was a small price to pay for gaining access to the archives. There would be hell to pay if I were ever caught. I'd face expulsion at the very least, but if I performed poorly in my admissions exam and received a tuition of 20 talents, I'd be just as good as expelled. So it was a horse apiece, really. Even so, I wasn't worried about being caught. The only lights in the stacks were carried by students and scribs. This meant it was always nighttime in the archives, and I have always been most comfortable at night.